Hello, my name is Fred E. Wall. The following is a recording made by my maternal granduncle, a Mr. Charles Dinker. This was made for his granddaughter, Artemis. It is his oral history of farm life in Garber, Oklahoma.
1997. Artemis, in your notebook here, you asked me to write down the stories, memories, thoughts, or whatever from your past. Well, Artemis, I've got a lot of past to write these things down from, so I'll do what I can. And I'll put conjectures in where I think they're necessary, and I don't know, there aren't too many people around who can correct me when I'm wrong. So we'll start out on that basis and see what I can do. And also, you must always remember that all that I'm saying in this first section here, the part about Garber, happened over 80 years ago. My parents were both immigrants. As you know, Dad came from Germany and my mother from Sweden. My dad was born in northern Germany in a diked country like Holland has dikes, but this part of Germany also had dikes. His people were farmers. And he said that they lived close enough to Wilhelmshaven, the big German naval base there, that he could hear the guns practicing over there. His dad's mother died when he was a child, and he was taken to the funeral. And at that dike country, the water level was very high, and he saw his mother's casket put in this watery grave, and it is something which naturally stuck with his child. And he always had a horror of being buried in the ground. And so when the mausoleum was built in Enid, he says, that's for me, and he wants some crypts there. So I don't think too much of mausoleums, but under the circumstances, I think he was very justified. Dad had several brothers and half-brothers before his dad finally remarried. His two brothers who remained in Germany were inducted into the army in World War I and fought all through the entire 4 years of it, and they weren't injured. When the war was over, one of the brothers wanted to get married. In Germany, you didn't marry unless you had a certain amount of property or money in the bank or something. Anyhow, you need to show an ability to support his wife. Well, he didn't have money in the bank or anything like that, so his brothers in the United States, there were several brothers over here by then, sent him enough money so he could marry. From this marriage, two children were born, a boy and a girl. When Hitler started acting up, the boy was old enough to be taken into the youth corps. And then when that time was up, he was taken into the German army, and he was sent into the Balkans, where he was killed. The girl never married. There just weren't enough men left in Germany to marry all the girls. During the American occupation of Germany after World War II, I had a nephew who was in the occupation forces who came around and tried to see her, but she refused to see him. I guess the Allied bombardment of Oldenburg, where she was living, was very vivid in her mind. I suppose several factors induced Dad to come to the United States. One was the advertisements which the land companies and the railroad companies were putting on in Europe, trying to get the immigrants to come to the United States to settle all this land they own. And of course, another one which was very important to Dad was the fact that he was reaching the age when, if he stayed in Germany, he would have to go into the German army, and he did not want to go into the German army. Now, I don't know which ship he came to the United States on. I know nothing about the trip. He landed at Castle Garden in New York, which was one of the immigration entrance points. From New York, for $1, the railroads would transport them to Chicago. In Chicago, Dad met, or somewhere, he got acquainted with the Brassfields. Evidently a very wealthy farmer who employed a number of people, and Dad went to work for him, and he worked, as near as I could tell, for him for about 9 years. I understand that the Brassfields lived somewhere in the Salem, Illinois area. Now, Some years earlier, this same area was where Abraham Lincoln did some of his clerking. Evidently, the Brassfields raised lots of sheep because Dad said that they killed a sheep about every third day to feed the employees. So one either liked mutton or they didn't get very much meat to eat. Now, my mother came from Sweden, and she, as near as I could figure out, must have come over when she was about 16 years old. And after the time she came here, she never saw either one of her parents. Her father was an alcoholic. He was a peat cutter by trade. And if one reads medieval history, why, they evidently lived in more feudal conditions, you know, where one man owned a lot of land and then he let the serfs farm a certain area of ground, and in return for that, they put in most of their time working for the owner. I gathered that my grandfather was not a very nice man. Now, there were several children in the family, and my mother's and my grandmother and my mother and these children knit sweaters for the trade. And my mother was put to knitting at such an early age that the bones in the fingers of her hands, which employed the knitting needle, were bent. As they just grew into that shape, and she had that to contend with all her life. I know nothing about her trip to the United States. I know nothing about where she landed in New York City. I know nothing about getting to Chicago or who she worked for there. But it was sometime in this period that she and Dad met. They saved up enough money so that they were able to buy a team of horses and a wagon. I assume it was a covered wagon, and I don't know if it was a Conestoga or not, but anyhow, they decided to, and they got married. They were married on the 1st of March in 1894, and two of my dad's brothers were witnesses, Uncle Chris and Uncle Ed. So I don't know if they had been here before Dad came here or if they came subsequent and they just had settled there. Uncle Ed stayed in Illinois and was a farmer. Uncle Chris went out into the panhandle of Oklahoma and was also a farmer out there. He stuck through the dust bowls and everything in that area, and he ended up owning, I don't say the whole panhandle, but he owned a big chunk of it. And considering the hardships, I'm sure he deserved everything that he got. My dad was 27 years old when he married, and Mama was 22. And I'm sure that they left for the Dakotas, where they were going to make their home, soon after the marriage, because they would want to have gotten into Dakota and gotten the spring crops in so they could have something to go on the next winter. Now, as I measured it, it was 560 miles from Salem, Illinois to Wagner, South Dakota. Now, driving a wagon in the dead of winter, that distance took some time. If they made 20 miles a day, it took 28 days. If they made 25 miles a day, they did it in 22 days, but that's as a crow flies. But considering the condition of the roads in that time and the several big rivers they had to cross, they probably traveled a good many more miles than this 560 miles, and it probably took them, I would say, 6 weeks at least to make the trip. Now, they had to carry provisions for their horses and provisions for themselves, so they must have, they could have stayed with farmers and things like that as they went along, because at that time, reliable company was a very welcome commodity on most of the rural inhabitants. But Artemis, you consider that length of time, that must have been one long cookout that Mama was glad to have over with when she finally arrived in South Dakota. One has to stop and think about the Indian situation in South Dakota at that time. In 1894, that were just four, a little over, that was just about 4 years since they had the trouble at Wounded Knee, where the Army broke the power of the Sioux Indian. Of course, the Wounded Knee was in another part of South Dakota, but the Indians all over South Dakota were very, very agitated as a result of this. They had two brothers. Uncle Charlie was living in South Dakota at that time, I'm sure, and then Uncle Gus also lived in South Dakota. Whether he was here then or not, I don't know. Uncle Charlie was a farmer. Uncle Gus was a banker. Uncle Gus died some years later from eating contaminated raw oysters. The folks rented a farm for a while, and then I understand that they bought one. And it was in South Dakota that my four oldest brothers and sister were born. Frank and I were the only two who were born in Oklahoma. Indians were constantly on the road then, and as far as I know, they were never belligerent to my parents. Mama used to say they would stop in and ask for food, and knowing her, I'm sure she never refused to feed any of them. Dad told me he raised quite a few cattle, and the market at that time was Chicago, and the only way to get them to market, to get the cattle to market, was to load them on a boxcar or several boxcars and go with them to market, because someone had to be there along with them to water them and feed them and look after them. And he made several trips into Chicago that way. And of course, then Mama was left home there with the kids. Dad also had a bearskin coat up there, which was very practical in South Dakota. But when he came to Oklahoma, he took the bearskin coat with him, and after 1 year in Oklahoma, he got rid of it. Another one of Dad's brothers, Uncle Henry, lived with the folks for a time there. He came somehow or another. He had been terribly burned, and Mama took care of him. After he healed, he left, and I don't know what happened to him. I understood one story is he went into the West and became a sheep herder. Others, I've heard another one, that he died someplace in Arkansas, but I know nothing about the man. He just someone that I've heard being talked about. Dad's move to Oklahoma was prompted by probably two factors that I have heard about. One, he said he couldn't stand the cold up there any longer. It was getting to him, and I can understand that. And I heard also that the Lutherans were very prominent there, and after services, well, the men would gather around and have a few beers, which upset Mama a whole lot, considering her experience with her father. So she objected to that, and so that was one of the reasons, which I've understood, that they decided to come to Oklahoma. Dad came to Oklahoma when it was still Oklahoma territory, and he looked around several places and finally bought a farm, a 160-acre farm, 3 miles straight south of Garber, Oklahoma. And he moved his family from South Dakota down to this farm. Now, my recollections of the place, starting from the public road, we had a road leading into the house, and the road on the west side of it was lined with ash trees. The house itself was, I guess you'd call it a story and a half. At one time, it had been painted pink. And starting from the west and moving to the east end of the house, on the west end was a large kitchen, and then a dining room, and the dining room had a peculiar characteristic in that as the house had settled, the dining room floor had not settled, so it had a bow in it, which seemed to me would have made some interesting problems living on it. But then going on east, there was a parlor, which was seldom used, and then clear at the east end was another bedroom, which was the folks' room. On the north, tacked onto the north end of the dining room was another bedroom. And there was a staircase going upstairs, and there were two bedrooms upstairs. The chimney from a heating stove in the middle of the living room, in the middle of the dining room, was went up between these two rooms, and that was the heat that was supplied to these upper rooms. I slept in one of these upper rooms, and I can remember being under everything that I could, every bit of clothing I could get, trying to keep warm. There was also a large part of the upstairs which had never been floored, and it was just an attic proposition there. Now, I have no recollection of ever seeing a book in this house. I know there was a Sears Roebuck catalog, and Mama being very religious, there was also a Bible, I'm sure. But there was no music. Newspaper, we must have gotten one because I can remember lying on the floor looking at the funnies, which at that time consisted, in this paper at least, of the Cats and Jammer Kids, and then there were some stick figures also, which were worked into some type of comic. We did have a telephone. It was fastened to the wall, and we were on a party line. And by a party line, I mean there could be 6, 8, 10, or 12 people on this line, and we each had our own individual signal. If you wanted to call your neighbor on that line, and they would have had a number of short and too long, or long and too short, or two longs and two shorts and two longs, or some combination of this way, and you just crank it that way, and then eventually they might pick up the phone, you could talk. My sister Anna was in nurse's training in Enid, and Mama phoned her occasionally to talk with her, and calling long distance in itself was an experience. Here, you know, you pick up the receiver, you hit a few numbers, and 10 seconds, why, you've got your party. Then you rang central, that's one ring, that would give you Garber. And at Garber, why, you tell him you want him to ring Cropper, which is the next town down the line. They'd ring Cropper, and when Cropper finally answered, you say you want him to ring Breckenridge. And that was the next town down the line. And you get Breckenridge, you say you want him to ring Enid and give them the number. And then eventually your party would answer. Of course, all this time the telephone line was tied up and no one else could use it. Of course, the other side of the coin is that the entire telephone line, all the other people on the line could be listening in while your conversation that you were having with Enid was having on that line. As you say, it was quite an experience. Of course, there were no radios or TVs. As far as I know, the concept of these hadn't even been thought of yet. There were phonographs around, but we never had one. As far as I can recall, I never saw one in the time that we were living at Garber. The kitchen, of course, was the hub of most of the activity in the house. It had a large wood-burning stove. And one end of it, of this stove, was a reservoir, which held maybe 10 gallons of water, hot water, when the stove was burning. Mama always kept a coffee pot boiling on the top of the stove. It was a gray enamel pot, as I remembered it. And as I remembered it, it also the pot didn't last too long. She made fresh coffee each Sunday morning, and she would add a few grounds and water each day through the year, through the week. So by Saturday, that was a pretty good coffee. I was given coffee to drink when I was still a suckling babe, maybe just very diluted. But I was brought up on coffee. I'm not a heavy coffee drinker today. Maybe a cup, two cups, that's usually my limit. In the kitchen, of course, beside cooking the meals, Mama made bread, lots of bread. Seems to me that she put the bread to rise in a tub. Now, I don't know if that was the same tub that she washed the clothes in or not, but it does seem to me that it was a big tub. And then she'd take the bread out of this and mold it into loaves and set them aside a while to finish rising, bake them, and it was, as I remember, some of the best tasting bread that I ever tasted. And of course, all of us, all the boys, wanted to get a hold of the heels of the bread. That was a prime piece. You take a hot heel that's still very hot and lather it down with some homemade butter. Now that's good eating. It was always my ambition that the loaf of bread would consist of be very narrow and consist of nothing but two heels. You could split it right down the middle, and there you'd have two heels that you could line it with mutter. This was also where the Saturday night washings took place for the family. I'm not saying that we all had a bath every Saturday night, but when they did take place, this was where it took place. And that was also in a tub, maybe the same tub. There was a porch adjoining on the north, and on this porch were kept some of the accoutrements of the farming. I believe that they had a churn. I know they had a churn there, but I believe they had some method of separating the cream from the milk. Maybe they just skimmed it off. I don't know. And outside the door of the porch was the windmill that supplied water. It had to be carried into the house, but it was closed, and it was very, very jibby hard. It had to be broken with lye when you wash clothes with it. Also on this back porch was a container of corn cobs soaking in coal oil. These were used to, these oil-soaked corn cobs were used to start the fire, the wood fire in the stove in the kitchen and in the living room. I drank some of that coal oil once. I also took the coal oil out once and poured it around a lilac bush and took some matches and lit the lilac bush on fire. I imagine that I got warmed up pretty good for that. And speaking of warming up, Mama always kept a peach limb above the kitchen door that she would enforce her authority with. She'd grab hold of our arm and we'd try to dance away from her, and she'd be switching the back of her legs, and I can't see that it did us any harm. And of course, if that happened today, she'd probably be brought up before the authorities on a child abuse charge. Close to the back door of the porch was a large cellar, a freighty hole, if you will. Nearly every farm had one there. And in it was kept the food which Mama canned for winter use. And I can't recall us ever using it for tornado purposes, but it was there just in case. In addition, there were several chicken houses. Mama always raised lots of chickens. She would set maybe a dozen hens, each hen having 12, 15 eggs. One of the hard handicaps, though, with doing that where we lived was that in wet weather, water stood all over all over the place to speak of, not deep, maybe an inch, but it was no environment in which to raise baby chicks. So amount of dirt was spaded up under each chicken coop where the mama and her babies stayed, and this got them up out of the water. I imagine the mortality on the chicks was very, very high. The two or three chicken houses there, we had boxes in them for the hens to lay the eggs in, and the boxes had straw in it. And also the hens had mites. These mites were brought in by sparrows, and they got to be a problem. I have remembered helping Mama work these hens over, trying to get rid of the mites. She would take lard and smear it around the eyes and around the hen's anus. This is because these are the places where their mites could get moisture, and we're trying to erect a barrier there so that they could no longer get moisture. My brother John saw these mites in one of these straw-filled nests one day, and he thought he'd get rid of them, and he brought some matches out and tried to burn out the one nest, and of course he ended up burning down the entire chicken house. I don't know, the Dinker boys, I think they've got some gene for pyromania. Me with a lilac bush, and John with a chicken house. There was an outhouse there, a two-holer. I was always scared to death of that, afraid I'd fall down one of those holes. There was a tool shed and a barn, maybe several barns. There was a windmill out by the barn, and to water the stock. There was a large watering trough there, which in the summertime I can remember getting in and washing off, and probably cooling off too, due to there were a couple of mud cats down in there that we caught and put in there to grow bigger. We always had a large garden. I especially remember the potatoes, because potatoes, plants have potato bugs, and it was one of my, I was put as a small child picking potato bugs. I was given a can of coal oil. So drop them into this can of coal oil. Before I go any further, Frank was born in Oklahoma, as I said before, and I'm sure he was born at this house. When he was a young child, he had a hernia operated on, and in order to keep him warm, a sad iron was wrapped in papers or claws of some type and put, I guess, between his arm and his chest to keep him warm, and it burned through, and as far I believe that he has the imprint of a sad iron on his body there to this day. I also was born in this house, and neighbors were there to help in the process. I suppose there was a doctor there, but I'm not certain. One of the neighbors I contacted years later when I needed to get a birth certificate. See, at that time, birth certificates were not recorded to the state capitol. But she could verify the fact that I was born, and so I was able to get my birth certificate. And getting back to Frank, he, when he was a little bit older, a few years older than he was when he had his burn, he wanted to drink, and the windmill was running, but it wasn't connected up to the pump. Well, usually there's a to connect it up. You put a metal bolt through there, and it connects it up, and the water runs. Well, he couldn't find a bolt, and now he didn't use it. He put his finger in there, and it took off, I suppose, about half of the finger down, about halfway down the nail. And to this day, when the nail comes out, it comes out in a circle. Probably the one of the few people in the world who has a finger there that the fingernail grows in a circle. Mama had long hair. I mean long, long hair. And she couldn't wash it, of course, in the jiffy water. So there was a barrel of, which was used to collect runoff water from the roof of the house. And that was collected just for her so she could have soft water to wash her hair. Mama always wore long dresses. I can't remember the day she died that she wore anything but a long dress. In summertime, she also made and wore bonnets. I can see those things. Seemed to me they were always made out of blue cloth of some type, and the bill went way out in front. It was held out there by pieces of cardboard which were sewn into the bill. Her shoes were long ones, come way up the calf, and they buttoned. She had a button hook that she'd button those things and tie them up there, and button them up there. Also, she, whenever she went out, she always wore a full corset. I can see her struggling to get into that thing. Word on one phase of cooking, I can remember her cooking cabbage, and she'd cook them and cook them and cook them until they were just yellow. Today, we cook cabbage. We steam it for a few minutes to kind of take the life out of it, and then we eat it. And that's just a difference in the way generations have changed in cooking. Sometime in here, the folks bought an incubator. It held, I believe, 100 eggs, and it was heated with coal oil. It was kept in the basement. Well, 100 eggs, that took the job away from about 6 or 7 hands. I don't know if they realized they'd been deprived of employment or not, but it was a fact of life. Dad raised lots of hogs. Now, by a lot of hogs, I'm not, I'd say 40 or 50, which sounds to me like a lot. That's nothing like in terms of today when they raised them to the thousands. But he raised these hogs not only to sell, but also to provide meat for his family. I never knew him to butcher a beef, but pork we always had. Now, in butchering a hog, the victim is selected and it is killed. Some people shot it with a .22. Dad always knocked him in the head with the back of back of an axe and cut their throats to drain them. Then they are pulled up there are, a single tree is used to fasten to the Achilles tendons in the back of each of the back legs, and they are pulled up head down. Any method to raise them up, tree limb or tripod or tongue off of a wagon or anything. Now this single tree I mentioned, it's the wooden thing behind a horse that the horse is hooked to drag an implement. And at the end of each one is a hook. And these hooks are what's hooked into the Achilles tendon of these pigs. And they get the pig up off the ground, head down, and then it is lowered into a barrel of boiling water. Now, you don't want to cook the pig at this place. You're just trying to get the bristles to relax. So it's dumped two or three times, then taken out, laid on a table. And butcher knives are employed to scrape the bristle off. The butcher knives are grabbed so that the cutting edge is straight down at a right angle to the hide of the hog, and then start scraping. It's quite a process. Once that is done, the hog is again raised up, head down. His head is removed. He is opened up, and the inside is dropped into a container of some type, and the parts you want to salvage are taken out using the liver and the heart. However, they say the Bohemians used everything of the hog except the squeal. Once this is done, the hog is split. They take a corn knife and position it over the middle of the back bone, and then take a hammer and start pounding on that corn knife, and it splits the hog right down the back. Well, when that finishes, you've got two halves. Now, at that time, hogs were raised to be fat, very, very fat, because the lard that they produced was the main cooking ingredient that all the kitchens all of the United States used, because there was no none of the oils that we are used to using today. Maybe they'd been thought of then, but they certainly were not common on the market. So they're just great chunks of fat. And these really fat portions were cut off and cubed and dropped into a cauldron to be boiled. And then the hams were taken off, and bacon, and the meat that's put aside for sausage. The head is the head is also removed, and from the head the eyes are taken out, and then the head is boiled to make head's cheese. Now, you have to go someplace else to find out the process of making head's cheese. I just remembered they made head's cheese. Now, these chunks of fat, which are put into a cauldron to boil, they are boiled and boiled and boiled, and until the fat no longer runs out. That's all the fat that's in them. Well, you've got some brown residues left. These chunks you've cut are now just brown chunks. They're called cracklings. And some people eat those things. I never cared for them. But they're mainly used to make soap. Lye is added to these. Water is added to them. And then they're boiled down until it comes almost to jelly. And then they're made into bars of soap. This is excellent for washing clothes. I mean, really dirty clothes. It's nothing that I would advocate to wash one's face or one's hair, but for the purpose of which they were intended, they were excellent. The sausage meat, of course, was ground. And put into crocks, 10-gallon crocks. And then this lard is melted until it's running, and then these crocks are filled with this hot grease. And when it's set, then you've just got a crock that looks like it's full of lard, but it acts as a preservative for this sausage. And in the summertime, we get ready to eat, have some sausage, you just dig down and bring up some sausage and start frying. Of course, it was a little greasy, but as I remembered, it was pretty good, and I haven't suffered any ill effects from it yet. Now, chickens are basically handled the same way. We eat lots of chickens. You take young chicken, maybe a 3-pounder, 3.5-pounder, that's happily and proudly running around the yard at 8 o'clock in the morning while he is nothing but a bunch of, but a pile of fried chicken by 12. In the process of preparing this for the table, the chicken is beheaded. He's chopped, head's chopped off with a knife, with an axe, or some people grab their head and bring them around and wring the head off of them. Then they're hung up to dry, hung up to drain. And then they, in turn, are dipped into buckets of boiling water for the purpose of loosening their feathers. The feathers are taken off. They are opened up then, and the insides are removed. And usually they save the liver and the gizzard and the heart. And then they're basically ready to be cut up and fried. Now, Artemis, that's what I would call fresh chicken. Somewhere along in here, I tried to smoke a cigarette. Maybe I smoked several of them. Today, we buy a package of cigarettes. That's basically, I'd say that's 90% of the cigarettes that are smoked. But then most everybody's rolled their own. They'd have a little sack of cigarette tobacco, and they'd have a packet of cigarette papers. They'd take out a cigarette paper, put the sprinkle the tobacco on it. They'd roll the cigarette. They'd lick it, put it in the mouth, and smoke it. Now, none of the boys smoked that I knew of, but somebody did. It gave me the idea. And so there was a weed growing there in the yard which had nice brown seeds on it. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was marijuana. But anyhow, I took a batch of those seeds, and I got a piece of newspaper, and I rolled those seeds up in that thing and that paper and got a match, and I smoked me a cigarette. I might have been one of the youngest pot smokers in existence at that time. I don't know. And I think of Mama's efforts to keep the clothes clean for that family she had. You had all these men working on the farm. You know those clothes got filthy. But she had a big wash tub out there in the yard on rocks. And she'd build a fire under that and haul water over and fill the tub. When it got boiling, she'd put in some soap and put these clothes in or wrestle them and boil them and till they were cleaner than they were when they went in, and then she'd have to take them out. Now, I can't imagine her rustling those heavy clothes around and that tub of boiling water and everything that went along with it. No wonder she died when she was just 56. As for our church going, I can't remember going too many times, but I'm certain that we attended frequently. We attended the Christian church in Garber. I don't believe there was a Lutheran church around, which, of course, that was the European religion which my parents brought with them. But the thing I remember most about the church was the long sermons and how my legs would ache sitting there on those hard pews listening to these sermons. And I'd tell Mama about it, and she said it was growing pains. And worse than the sermons were some of those interminable prayers. These guys would get up, they'd pray, and they'd pray, and they'd pray, and I don't think there was anybody, time they finished, I don't believe there was anybody around who hadn't been prayed for. I always thought there were so many good places in there for them to stop. I remember one Christmas party, or one Christmas program we had in the church, and it was lighted with a gasoline lamp. We use coal in our house, but they had a gasoline lamp there. The only thing is, although the lamp gave a brilliant light, there was a flaming glass gasoline that run down the side of the lamp and drip onto the floor. Evidently, it was a lamp was malfunctioning. And to keep from burning the church down, there was a pile of sand put down there. I suppose that today the fire marshal would say that was very unsafe, and I suppose it was very unsafe then, too. One Christmas Eve, I know they had gave us some little presents, apple and orange and some hard candies, that I remember. Baptisms were held in farm ponds. You used to chase the cows out first, of course. And then, as I remembered, after the baptism, why, there was usually a picnic there. So it was a festive occasion for more than one purpose. And Mama would have the minister out for Sunday dinner, seemed to me quite frequently. And about that time, I had decided that I was going to be a minister because he always got the best pieces of the chicken and the best pieces of everything. And, of course, I was eating at the kitchen table with probably two or three other children. And we had what some people would consider the less desirable pieces of the chicken. We had neighbors, but they weren't close neighbors. I mean, in the sense they didn't live right next door. On the east of us were some people by the name of Wishard. They were three-quarters of a mile east of us. And then to the southeast, about a mile and a quarter, was the Bellevilles. And then about a half a mile southwest of it, the Wolfs lived. They had several children. I remember they had a little girl about my age, named Irene, I believe is what her name was. I just remember she existed. I remember nothing else about her. And then there were two families of Dibleys lived about a mile and a little over a mile southwest of us. A man and his sisters, they had each homesteaded land there. Clarcy Dively was the sister. She was an old maid. And John Dively and his wife lived west of theirs. I remember walking over there one day with my mother. Mrs. Dively made the best pies. I mean, I don't know, she did something with baking the crust and then sprinkling sugar on them afterwards, but I thought they were the best tasting pies I ever ate. And she also baked baking powdered biscuits for three meals a day. Now, she mixed up her dry ingredients once a week so that for these biscuits, so that when it came time to bake, it wasn't much of a job just to mix what moisture she's going to put in them and stir them up a little bit, and they were ready to bake. They also had geese, and I was mortally afeard of that gander. He didn't like me. He'd come after me, and you could see why the from an evolutionary standpoint, the birds, of which he was one, was fairly closely connected to the snakes. Then right west of us, the Mullins lived. They were half a mile west of us. Mrs. Mullen used to fix me peanut butter on crackers, and I always got a headache from it. We never had peanut butter in our home, and I dearly loved it, but evidently I had a little allergy to peanut butter. And then a mile north of us, there was another family that lived that I don't even remember their name. Also in this community were three families of Murphys. I think they came from Arkansas. There was one family of Kellys and Searcys. And there were a lot of people around, but they just weren't close. My brothers ran trap lines in the wintertime, and I went with them occasionally. They'd catch skunks, possums, and things of that nature, take them home and skin them and stretch them. And they sold them, it seems to me, mainly to Sears and Roebuck, who had a big fur buying program on at that time. Also, on the Mullins place, they had a beautiful creek there, the springs and everything else, and it hollowed out a nice little pond in there, we'd go swimming there in the summertime. I can remember being there with my brothers, and we'd have green gourds that we'd throw at each other. I always envied the Mullins, that water. They're sweet and pure and so abundant, and here we were half, three-quarters of a mile away from them, and what we had was drinkable, but that was about all. Of course, all roads then were mud. None of them were surfaced. I suppose in the towns they had surfaces, but some surfacing, but even there it was bricks, of which you can still see a great deal of that around here. And these roads were maintained by a poll tax. Every male, when he became 21 years old, he owed a poll tax. 2 days of work with a team of horses or $10, I believe, is the way it went. Dad was a superintendent for a while of a certain section of road, and they kind of graded it up and got a little drainage on it, but there wasn't a whole lot you could do with the equipment that they had then to maintain the roads. Somewhere in here, we had a total eclipse of the sun. It was the middle of the afternoon, and it was so total that the chickens went to sleep, went into their barn, into their sheds, and went to sleep. And I was out in the pasture when that hit, and I can remember how frightened I was about it. Of course, this farm that Dad had was a wheat farm. Most of his income came from this wheat. It was planted in the fall, in the late September, October, early November, and then it grew all winter long, and if it had a fairly rank growth, you could pasture cattle on it through the winter, and it wouldn't use so much hay. And then along 1st of June, it was ready to harvest. And one year, Dad used a header barge, went in there, and just clipped the heads off and put them up into stacks and threshed them out of the stacks. But most of the time, they were a binder would go in, and they'd bind these, they'd cut and bind the wheat into bundles. These bundles were kicked out, and then shockers, men would come by afterwards, and they would pick up these bundles, some by hand, some with a pitchfork, and put them, 15, 20 bundles to a shock, and let the heads up, see, so that they could dry out. This was all done, all the power, of course, was horses. They'd push or pull the equipment, and then there was a big bull wheel in the middle, which as it turned on the ground, it would force the other machinery, other parts of the machine to operate, and that's the way it worked. Of course, today we have combines. That big combine, the cutting of the wheat, and the shocking of the wheat, and the threshing of the wheat, it's all in one thing. These combines today, they're air-conditioned, radios in them, two-way communication. Maybe some of them have TVs, and they're very expensive. They cost $100,000, maybe $125,000.
I got a little ahead of my myself there when I mentioned the combines, because in addition to the harvesting of the wheat, we also had to have it threshed, and this was accomplished by usually a commercial thresher. He had a machine which made a number of farms, and powered by a steam engine, which would come chugging down the road pulling the separator. They'd pull it out into the field, usually and try to get it in the center of a field where which is full of shocks, and they'd set it up, bundle wagons would go out and pick up these bundles out of the shocks and drive up to this up to the separator here and throw them in there, and they'd thresh out the grain and blow the straw out into a huge straw stack. You look across the country at that time, and there's scarcely a farm that didn't have one or more of these straw stacks. With this threshing machine, there was a cook shack. It was rather a long device and narrow, and the inside of it was equipped to do the cooking for these crews. And the sides would drop out and form tables so that the people could come by and pick up their food, and that was the way it worked. It was always an ambition of mine to eat in one of these cook shacks, but that's one of my many ambitions which was never realized. The crew on these threshing machines usually consisted of the neighbors. That is, you help me with my wheat, and when they're in your place, I'll come over and help you with yours. It was about this time that oil was discovered in this Garber Covington oil field. The number one Hoy, the discovery well, is a shelf well, I suppose about 1,200 feet. But it was located about a mile and three quarters southeast of our house. I remember one Sunday, Tom took me over to it, and it had just been discovered. And I suppose Tom had to carry me a good part of the way because I was still quite small. But soldiers were guarding this well. This was during World War One, and or the approach of World War One, and the Army and the Navy especially wanted all the oil they could get. There were little rivets running down into the creek. Of course, at that time, any thing that came out of the well that you didn't want or you couldn't catch, why, it was allowed to go into the creeks and spoil a number of beautiful creeks all this debris did. And the field went ahead and developed from there until eventually it had put some wells on most places that Dad owned. The materials that went into building these rigs, they were wooden rigs, came, I believe, all out of Covington, and of course it was brought out with a team and for these wells, and they brought it out regardless of the weather. The roads were axle deep in mud, they still came out. But the driver, who's called a mule skinner, and he would I'd have a 20-foot long bull snake, and there was some horse up in one of the teams that was a mule that wasn't doing his job. Well, he could take that snake and that bull snake and reinterest the animal in his job. It was a miserable existence for animals, I will admit. One of the sounds which sticks with me is the sound of building these wooden rigs. They were put together with probably a 60-penny nail and a hatchet. And these rig builders had put these wooden rigs up, so they were fast. Sometimes they put them up in a day. But the sound of these hatchets hitting on these 60-penny nails on a clear day, still day, would carry for a huge distance. And that peculiar sound, I can still hear it. Referring to the subject of our neighbors, Mullins had one son, Alfred, a nice guy, but he chewed tobacco. And there was always a stream of tobacco juice on his chin. That was characteristic. You saw Alfred, and you saw that stream of tobacco juice. And Mrs. Mullen offered me a dime for every turkey nest that I could find. Her turkeys ranged and roamed, and she'd like to know where they would nest out. I can't recall that I ever collected any dimes, but I did a lot of looking for turkey nests. And a while ago, I said we had some neighbors named Kelly. It wasn't Kelly, it was McCoy. They were Irish Roman Catholics. They lived right west of the Liberty School. And they had a death in the family, and one of the superstitions that this particular family had, and maybe it's characteristic of a lot of people, was that the grave had to be opened and closed in the same day. That is, if you open the grave in the morning and you had the funeral in the afternoon. And of course, the neighbors, when the need arose, the neighbors all chipped in, I say, they all came around and they all took turns in digging the graves. And evidently, at some time in this period, one of the McCoys died and had to employ this. That's just one of the superstitions. One or more of our neighbors was a sinner. That is, when the Cherokee Strip was opened to settlement and the people all came in and staked their claims, these sinners were people who had slipped in and hidden out, and they were already on location the day that the strip was opened. The army went through and tried to locate all these people and chase them out, but many of them were so well hidden that they were able to stay and protect the land on which they staked their claims. Also, I mentioned that Dad raised pigs for the market and for use by his family. One year, I remember that his pigs got either cholera or pneumonia, and they all died or had to be killed. I can see the fire out in the orchard where Dad had piled all these pigs up and piled some brush and everything on and was burning them. Also, Mama raised lots of turkeys. She tried to keep them in this orchard. It had a had a fence around it, but the turkeys were wild. They weren't the kind of turkeys you have today when they're all breast and can't fly. These things can fly, and they did. And Mama wasn't the only one that liked these turkeys because the coyotes loved them. And it was trying to keep the coyotes away from them that made her try to keep the turkeys in this orchard. Also, it was a spring ritual for Mama to take all the beds out of the house, tear them to pieces, and put cola on all the joints. This was to kill the bed bugs. Now, I have no recollection of ever being bothered with bed bugs, but for some reason or another, she did this, and it was quite a job. Also, Artemis, I forgot to mention that my mother was a twin. So when you start having your family, you don't be surprised if twins might show up. A little footnote, which I should have mentioned when I mentioned Mama and the wood stoves. We didn't always burn wood in theirs. I remember going into the pasture and gathering cow chips, dried cow chips, to use as fuel. Now, the thought of doing this might be a little repulsive, but they burned with a hot, clear blue flame and absolutely odorless. And if you lack wood, they made an excellent substitute. I never knew Dad to take a drink of any kind. I have just a hearsay that about the beer drinking in South Dakota, but and also the story goes around that he had a bottle of whiskey which he hid out in the corn crib, and the boys found this, and they take little nips out of this bottle and replace it to the original level of liquid with water. So I imagine in time that there wasn't a whole lot of kick left in this whiskey. About this time, Mama took Frank and myself to a trip to the Dakotas, Iowa, and to Illinois. Dad had, of course, he had brothers living in the Dakotas and in Illinois, and she had a brother living in Sioux City, Iowa. I remember Uncle Charlie in South Dakota, the magnificent teams of horses that he had. He had a huge barn there for them, and they seemed to me to be so much bigger and better horses than what we had. In Illinois, at Uncle Ed's, I was first introduced to the mysteries of electricity. He would actually switch a button down at the bottom of the stairs, and a light would come on at the top of the stairs. Now, as a very young child, I was very, very impressed with that. In the visiting her brother in Sioux City, he had two sons, Hugo and Ramus, my cousins, and they had every toy in the world, including an electric train. I envied them, but I really can't recall having any particular problem with these. Dad evidently didn't have much of a musical nature, but he did have one song which he sang, and it's the only song I ever heard him sing. He had no oats to feed his goats, and he had no corn to feed his shoats. When Oklahoma Territory became a state, they made rather generous provisions in the Constitution for their education system. Sections 13, 16, and 36 were dedicated for educational purposes. Now, I mentioned these numbers. Oklahoma is made up of townships. Each township is 6 miles on a side, and that makes a square of 36 square miles each, and each square mile consists of 640 acres. But of this, as I say, section 13, 16, and 36 were dedicated to the schools. Now, one-room schoolhouses dotted were all over the place. I understand they were ideally supposed to be located so that no youngster had to walk more than a mile and a half to school. I never saw them quite that close. Liberty School, where all my brothers and my sister, I don't know if Tom actually attended there, he might have been too old, but the rest of them all attended, was located just a mile and less than a mile, about a mile and a half west of where we lived. It was abolished the year that I started school, which was in 1917 and 1918, and the students were sent to Garber to school. That'd be Fred, John, Frank, and myself had a buggy drawn by a horse by the name of Daisy, and that took us in. I can't remember bad weather or bad roads or anything, but we know we had them during an Oklahoma winter. But we took the horse in and drove the horse in and stabled it somewhere. I don't know, but somewhere. And then in the evening, well, we'd drive it home. Now for food, Mama, all I can ever remember her fixing us was fried egg sandwiches packed into a half-gallon, empty half-gallon syrup pail. Folks bought lots of syrup as sweetener for us. But, you know, when you've had a egg fried in lard, put in between two pieces of homemade bread, and packed into an airless container like a syrup bucket, that probably was done about 6 or 7 in the morning, and you eat it at noon, that produced a smell and a taste which is very individual for that particular offering. I still remember that it was good. Don't get me wrong. I had no problem eating it, but it's the only place I can ever remember having anything like that. The school had burned sometime before I started the school and was being rebuilt, and I started the school in a Christian church there. Sometime during the year, the school was finished and moved over there, and we had a first grade, had a room in the basement. Now, Mrs. Smith was the teacher. I evidently was not the most brilliant of students. I can't remember ever having had anyone read to me, and certainly no one taught me the alphabet. But I remember one recess being down in the well. Cut in the ground right put outside the windows to basement room so that the light could get in, being down in there. And I felt so elated that I was able to count up to 100. Now, that was quite an achievement, I thought. But that's the only thing that I remember about that school. Oh, I remember I liked girls, and there was a little round-faced girl in there by the name of Hoover. I don't think I ever spoke to her, but I thought she was very special. Now, the kids wouldn't play with me. I was one of these dirty foreigners, and I'm sure, considering the conditions at home and in bathing, I probably wasn't as clean as some of these people were. But I can only remember one friend there, Paul Johnson. His dad, I believe, was the junk dealer. Oftentimes, in going to and from along the streets in Garber, I would pick up aluminum foil. All chewing gum then was individually wrapped in aluminum foil, and cigarette tobacco sometimes was wrapped in aluminum foil. And the theory was, if you got a pound of aluminum foil, reclaimed aluminum foil this way, you could sell it to the junk dealer for a dime. I don't remember ever having accumulated that much aluminum foil, but then maybe I did. One time at the school, they had a carnival or something at night, and the students were supposed to bring things to for entertainment, and I know the boys, maybe just one of them, I've seen to me, John was hooked up with it. They got one of Mama's long black stockings and stuffed it with the papers, except for a space right in the middle. And they put a cat in there, the legs sticking out through holes, and it was supposed to be turned loose and shake this sock, like the stocking, like it was a snake. Well, I guess when they turned it loose, the cat took off. And that was the last they heard of that particular cat. Sometime in here, Dad bought a car. I think it was a Ford Touring. It had sides open, and in bad weather, you'd had a kind of a cloth covering that you could put in there. This covering had isinglass windows that you could put out. This would keep out part of the weather. It had to be cranked, of course. It used a clutch to get started with instead of a gear shift like we have today or automatic shift. The lights, and I don't know what they were, carbide or coal oil or what they were, but they were mounted out on the front of the front fenders, which they in turn were kind of square sticking out. This car we had till we moved from Garber, and it was sold at the sale. One time Dad let us take that, the four of us boys take it into Enid to a movie. The name of the movie was The Kaiser, the Beast of Berlin. Now remember, this was during World War I. It was the movie was held at the American Theater, which was in the east side of the Oxford Hotel. We were told that when we turned a corner, we had to stick out our hands. Either there were no street lights or street signals of any kind. So when we came to a corner, there were four sets of arms stuck out to make the turn. I know we almost got stuck in the sand right east of Enid there at Boggy Creek. There was no, the sand was just deep and the road were in roads, were in roads in name only. I remember Dad telling about one Christmas at Liberty School. Now, at that time, there were few evergreens in this country. They've been mainly an introduced species, you know, in cemeteries and around the house plantings and such. But there were a few cedars growing in different places, and Dad and I believe the county superintendent of schools collected a few of these branches, and they also got some peach branches, and they wired the peach branches together to make a framework, and they tied these bits of evergreen onto the peach branches, and that was their Christmas tree, and I guess it was very, very successful. One thing we children could always count on was an angel food cake that Mama made for us on our birthdays. Whites of 11 eggs, and then pink frosting and the works. The yellows, the eggs were used, as I remember, to make mayonnaise, but I can't ever remember eating any of that mayonnaise. Thinking back over what I have said here, conditions seem to be rather grim, and I suppose they were to a certain extent, but they were good times. Whenever anybody had a birthday in the neighborhood, then neighbors would gather around for it. There were frequent picnics in groves and on creek banks and stuff like that. And, of course, there were, I'm sure there were church doings that everybody attended. But the neighbors were a very supportive group in all matters. Dad was always telling us that if we didn't watch out, we'd go to the poorhouse. Now, you don't know what a poorhouse is, but at that time, every county supported a poorhouse where the people who were indigent couldn't make it. That's where they ended up. The county was taking care of them. Of course, Dad is exaggerating, but then nevertheless, that was one of the things that he always talked to us about. Somewhere in this time, Tom was drafted into the Army and sent to France. Of course, that was a very traumatic thing for my parents, and I suppose for us kids, too. Tom was, I don't know, he was in France for quite a while. He was in the Company A, 122nd Engineers. I think he was a corporal or something of that nature. They were chiefly engaged in building railroads. I think I heard him say once that they would work at night to build these railroads up close to the front, and then in the daytime when what the work they had done was visible, while the German artillery shells would tear them up. Now that doesn't sound be like anybody was getting very far there. The folks always ran a bill at the grocery store. Maybe all the farmers did, I don't know. But all they had to do was buy the basics, you know, the flour and the sugar and syrup and things like that, just things that they didn't grow. And I don't know if they paid it up once a year or how often, but I was with them when they ran that, when they charged things, and there was never any problem about it. And one day when I was alone, I went into the grocery store and I charged a penny's worth of candy to this account. And I lived in mortal fear that I would be punished for that, but nothing was ever said about it. My guess is that the man who owned the grocery store probably laughed and never said anything to folks about it. At the end of school, my first year, I received quite a shock. Mama took me into town and bought me some summer underwear. Summer underwear? I had been used to being put into my long handles, I guess, sometime in November, taken out sometime in April. And that was the extent of the underwear that I wore. I don't believe I ever even knew that people wore underwear in the summertime. But they were BVDs, and this is in preparation for us moving to Colorado. Mama and Frank and I went out first, and then Dad and John and Fred stayed in Oklahoma and took care of the crop and had a sale and all that type of stuff. Basically, this concludes the things that I remember about the period of time that we lived in Garber. Now, I'm sure that in the future, I'm going to think of dozens of incidents that I wished I'd put on here, but I didn't. This is just what's come to me. The next session will deal with the year that we spent in Colorado. One other thing here on the trip that when we were in the Dakotas and Iowa and Illinois, I forgot to mention that there was another mother, had another brother up there, Uncle Alfred. I don't know just where he lived. I have very few recollections of him living up there. I believe he ran a dairy, and the part that impressed me was that he had a lot of bees. I don't think these bees caused me any trouble, but they were still impressed on my memory. Artemus, you know, I think you are probably one of the luckiest people that I know. You were a beautiful baby. You are developing into a gorgeous-looking woman. You have brains. You possess personality. You live where you have all the opportunity in the world. And not the most important thing is that you have a family who loves you. Two corrections. When we were talking about South Dakota, I mentioned that there were four boys born there. There were only three: Tom, Fred, and John. And also, when we were talking about burning cow chips or buffalo chips, those were oftentimes referred to as prairie coal.